Offside with Andrew Gunling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gunling back from Ireland. JJ Devaney, what's up, brother?
Happy New Year, sir. How are you?
Yeah, same to you. Same to you. New Year off to a good start, a very interesting start for the American fan as our prized joy.
Our boy's grown up.
Yeah, he really has, and now he's ready to flee the nest, sort of. I guess he kind of did that when he went to Germany all those years ago.
Yeah, that was the main nest fleeing. Yeah. Now this is just moving to a...
Right, Hershey to Germany is far bigger of a nest fleeing than Germany to London. But we're going to talk all about it, and we actually have a special guest in studio with us to talk about it. You, of course, read his stuff at Sports Illustrated. He has an incredibly popular podcast, Planet Football Podcast. You see him on Fox. It's Grant Wall. What's up, man? How are you?
Hey, guys. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Grant. It's great to have you in.
I'm psyched to be here. I was just telling you before we started recording, very professional-looking situation here in the studio, far more than my podcast.
Well, Grant, I just want you to acknowledge that this isn't done in some shoebox on the Lower East Side or something like that, because people question us.
Oh, absolutely.
All the time.
And we are not taken seriously.
Well, no, we are, in my view. It irks you that people question us.
Well, yeah, I can't handle social media.
Right.
I stay off of it. I never read mentions. They terrify me. But it's great to have you in here because obviously Christian Pulisic is, you know, I listen to podcasts from England and things like that, and he's not just a story here, where he's always a story, but he's a story over abroad as well, as he's now made his record move for an American, of course, $73 million from Borussia Dortmund to Chelsea, then immediately loaned back to Borussia Dortmund. I mean, I guess we'll get right into it, and there's no other place to start than with this.
It's time for Boy Wonder Why, Christian Pulisic. Oh, that boy really is special.
It's funny, actually, JJ, I got a tweet from at JAbe2,
right,
who tweets at us, who's a Tottenham fan. He said, at A. Gunling, you have to kill Boy Wonder Watch. He's part of the opposition now. I'm a Tottenham fan as well. We were talking about that.
And the we'll joy get, and we'll the get into angst the, is unbelievable.
We'll get into the meat of this, but like... That is something I got a lot of. I saw a lot of that of Tottenham fans and Arsenal fans saying, you know, who are Americans saying, what do we do now that this American player is now like part of the enemy? And like, I think like American sports fans have been able to compartmentalize stuff like that just inherently. Like, I went to Syracuse. I loved Carmelo Anthony for what he did for the Orange. And, you know, I hate the Knicks. And then he's a Knick. And you figure it out. Like, you can continue to love Pulisic even if he's playing for the opposition. I don't think that's a big deal at all.
Roy Keane was a god to me, and he played for the team I hated most in the world. But you secretly were like, when he was going around the field bossing Zidane, you're like, go on, yeah, that's good. Ah. You can do it. Soccer fans can do that. I'm right, Grant, aren't I?
This is part of being a fan and part of, like, you learn to do it. You do it in different sports. I think American soccer fans are a savvier bunch than they sometimes get credit for. And so, sure, I think it's going to be possible for people who are diehard Arsenal fans or whomever fans to see Christian Pulisic play for Chelsea. And we'll see if he plays. I think he will. And then play for the U.S., which he's already been doing pretty well.
What was your gut, your instant reaction when you saw the news?
I wasn't totally surprised because
the
news
rumors
had been popping up. Really over weeks, but especially over a period of days where you really did sense that a move was imminent, or at least an announcement, because he's not actually making a move
right
yet. And I think there were a few factors that put Chelsea in a position to want to get a deal done and drive that sooner rather than later. One of them, I think, is that there is a real fear on their part of a transfer ban starting this next summer.
Right.
And I think they were willing to pay more for Pulisic as a result than other clubs were. You know, we've talked a lot over the years about the relationship between Jurgen Klopp and Christian Pulisic, and it's a real relationship. This was a guy, Klopp, who hugged Christian and his dad when they first visited Dortmund, and they decided to go to Dortmund, among other clubs. So there was a real relationship that continued as long as Klopp was there and continued after Klopp left. So, you know, one thing to keep in mind here is that coaches don't always have the lead position in driving transfers.
No.
And I think people saw that a little bit with what Sarri said after the Chelsea game this week when he said that he only knew that this purchase was going to happen the day before. But there was a lot of shock at that in certain quarters of the U.S. in particular, but that's the division of labor these days for the most part between a technical director and a coach.
Especially at a club where you can be guaranteed Christian Pulisic is going to be in a Chelsea jersey next season. And that's not the case with a Chelsea manager, even if it is Maurizio Sarri. And I guess that's the policy. And Bruce Buck, being an American, also probably had an eye towards, look, we can't lose getting this guy in from a marketing standpoint, and also the fact he's an excellent player. It was a win-win.
It is. And I'm not going to be overly critical of, is Chelsea a bad place for Christian Pulisic? When you pay 64 million euros, $73 million, you're not going to loan the player out next season.
Right.
He's not Matt Miazga. You know, this is a completely different situation. This is one of the top 25 or 26 highest transfers in the history of the sport. And so when you look at it in those terms, he's going to get every opportunity to not just earn a starting position, but be a main part of the attack at Chelsea.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that, like, because I come at this as the American soccer fan who wants to know, okay, what is in the best interest of his development so he can continue to be this great star that he's been for the U.S.? And, you know, part of me looks at Chelsea and you see Hazard and Willian and even Pedro, and you wonder, is there a place for him? But then I look at that price tag and I think, $73 million, are you spending that on a sub? I mean, like,
no.
It feels to me like he is... Like, there is another move that is going to be coming that will create a spot for him, I would think.
One of those three guys, maybe two,
yeah,
that you mentioned, are not going to be there when Pulisic joins the team. That is my feeling. Or at least they will move before, in the summer window.
Uh-huh.
Hazard, we know about, has expressed publicly a desire to go to Real Madrid. He could go elsewhere, too. Willian Pedro, both over 30, still good players, but I think it's very likely or impossible that Pulisic's side in the decision-making process has some information about potential moves that Chelsea might make as well.
Who is he being advised by? Is his family kind of serve as his agent? Does he have
He has an agent, a guy named Rob Moore. A South African guy who lives in the UK, represents a fair number of young youth U.S. national team players, Pulisic's age, represents guys like Haji Wright over in Germany, a few other guys too. And the family of Christian Pulisic is very influential in everything he does.
Yeah.
His father, Mark, was over there at Dortmund with him for 2 years when he first moved over there. It's a close family. His mom was a former player at George Mason, very much in constant communication. She was constantly visiting Christian at times in Germany over the last few years.
I wonder, with him having moved from Borussia Dortmund to Chelsea, you know, watching him kind of come up as a Borussia Dortmund player, it was so exciting to see this young American thriving like that at such a prominent club, and he's playing in the Champions League, and it's, you know, you're excited to see it, even as somebody who doesn't root for Borussia Dortmund. And then, you know, Jadon Sancho's emergence. Did you feel like Pulisic had to get out of there? Had he pretty much plateaued at Dortmund and it was just, you know, his time was basically up at that club?
I think he wanted to make a move this next summer for a while, and that was before the emergence of Sancho, because the mere fact that Pulisic's contract went through the summer of 2020 suggests that he expected to be sold a year out from that. Nobody signs a contract in Europe thinking they're going to play out the entirety of their contract. And so the timing of that, the second he signed that and we knew it was for 2020, you could have predicted this next summer is when he was expecting to make a move.
Yeah, the clock was certainly ticking at that point.
Now, I got excited by this move. I can see the pros and cons of it because of Chelsea's past with younger players and signing players that don't play, even older players. But obviously, this is a different position money-wise. What interests me is the club in general and the direction it's going creates an opportunity for Christian Pulisic, because I can't see Hazard being, he's 28, I can't see him being at Chelsea next season.
Right.
I think he will make that move. And I think Pulisic could now, and I got to be careful the way I phrase this, take the reins creatively in that side. I see an opportunity that excites me. You've got the transfer ban. You've also got a chairman that may not be involved in the club very much longer, which may limit their spending power because of his visa. Do you see the same opportunity for me that I see for Pulisic to come in and not just be a bit part player, be an actual a star, a creative star in this side?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if he's not, I mean, he's got to have the ambition that he becomes a star at Chelsea. Otherwise, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Because he's at Dortmund, a team that is on track to win the Bundesliga, that is very much alive in Champions League, that there aren't too many places to go up from Dortmund to.
No.
And so if you're at Chelsea, this is a move for Christian Pulisic to go from being still a complementary player, he's not one of Dortmund's top two players right now.
No.
Never has been. Right. But somebody who is capable of becoming that, this is the next step in his career. The dollar figure that's now going to be attached to him for a long time indicates that this is a player who's going somewhere to be a star.
Are there things in his game that you would say watching both leagues have to change?
You know, I don't think his game, I think it's a good fit for the Premier League. This is a player who is very much into quick transitions. And movement and win the ball and move. First thing is to find, you know, what's available in an attacking position.
Yeah.
You know, I spent a lot of time with Christian, you know, book plug for,
that's
for
right.
Masters of Modern Soccer. It's the first chapter of my book. Very intelligent kid who goes into detail about how he views the craft of the attacking midfielder position that he plays. And I was blown away because he held his own in a chapter with Xabi Alonso as the defensive midfielder who had lived a lot more and seen a lot more at the time than Christian had. He was a teenager when I first did the interviews for the book. And this is a guy who I think has been watching the Premier League his entire life. He spent a year in England growing up. You could say that he fell in love with the game to a new level as a kid. In that year in England, playing and watching and consuming us, you know, that culture, it's, you guys know it. I mean, it's just football's everywhere. And so I think this is something that he feels like it's a good move. He's been in a good position in Germany to get to this point. Dortmund, as big as it is still viewed as a stepping stone club if you want to be one of the best players in the world. And so far, so good. Obviously, he's not there yet. And there are things that need to improve in his game that he is his own worst critic, that he would tell you that's the case in terms of finishing, in terms of better end product, more of the time, whether it's finishing, whether it's crossing, whatever. And I think, too, working on being healthy. Which is an important thing. This is a guy who's had three muscle injuries this season.
That calf of his should probably give people more concern than his actual like ability or his ability to play at Chelsea.
You don't want to become known as a player who gets injured often, and he's not that yet by any means. This is no Arjen Robben type situation. But if you develop a reputation as someone who doesn't play more than 60% of the time or isn't healthy enough most of the time, that would be a big problem.
Yeah. You mentioned before the time that you spent with him, and I wanted to ask you about that. You know, playing at Borussia Dortmund, you know, like you said, he's not one of the two best players. I would even, maybe this is stretching it a little bit, but I would even say you can almost blend in if you're Christian Pulisic at Borussia Dortmund. Maybe that's true at Chelsea too, but when you see a price tag like that attached to a player at such a high-profile club, he really can't blend in. Like, there's going to be a spotlight on him. What is his personality? Is he suited for that kind of scrutiny and that kind of attention? He's only 20 years old still. I mean, we've known about him for so long. You feel like he's older than that, but he's still a kid, really. How will he handle all that?
I think he'll handle it well. He's been in a pressure cooker situation for quite a while now over in Dortmund. And I remember talking to him, you know, his first full season with Dortmund. And he was very upfront about saying, I'm grappling with the change in how I'm viewed when I walk out in the street here. I've never dealt with that before. You know, I've seen Marco Reus deal with that here in Dortmund. But this is a completely new thing for me, and I'm not the most natural guy. He's not, you know, on the face of it, a guy who is all about charisma and playing to the crowd in terms of his speaking. Now, he's also wise enough at a very young age to make the point that, like, I feel that way when I'm playing.
Yeah.
Like, he says that. But it's something he's had to learn a little bit in terms of how he presents himself in the media, in interviews, not just in English, but in German, which I think is a credit to him that he learned German and was able to speak German well in interviews. He's obviously not going to have to worry about that as much now that he's going to be playing in London. But
he has to go the Brad Friedel route and develop a little bit of a British accent.
We'll wait and see if he gets something like that. And, you know, I do think there are times when he's gotten to a point in big group media sessions where he kind of goes on autopilot, as so many athletes do.
Yeah.
Where it's sort of striking to me, if you like compare that to one-on-one interviews or like the stuff that we did talk about in my book, where you can tell what he's capable of when he wants to really be insightful.
What does he like outside the game?
He loves America. Loves watching American sports constantly. Big fan of Philadelphia teams. He's from Pennsylvania. You know, this is a guy who told me he once drove 2 hours each way to a Chipotle in Frankfurt to get Chipotle, which, I mean...
That was the nearest one?
Like Chipotle, but I was like, dude, it's not that great,
no.
Is it? You know, and so, like, clearly a guy who likes being tied and thinking about the U.S., and I think if he could be doing what he's doing in the U.S., he would love to do that. He just can't.
How affected was he by them not qualifying?
U.S.?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
You could see it on his face after. I mean, he was, you know,
well,
tears.
Well, in the near term, there's, you know, descriptions of scenes that night in Trinidad of him crying in the shower.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. But even long term, so that was in October. I remember seeing Christian and his parents in late December. So you're talking about 2.5 months later, and just talking to his dad at that point and him saying how raw it still was 2 months later. Because when you think about it, it's missing a World Cup. You don't get many opportunities in your entire career for it. And it would have been something that could have catapulted Pulisic into superstardom in the United States, which, strangely, he doesn't have yet, but he doesn't. What you do for the national team is always, as long, you know, these days at least, going to influence your popularity in America, your people's awareness of you, far more than anything he does at club level. And that's just the nature of the beast. You know, I remember doing a search on Google Trends on searches, online searches for Christian Pulisic, and comparing the moments in the magnitude of those that interest for moments in the U.S. uniform versus moments in a Dortmund uniform, including scoring the goal that sent Dortmund to the quarterfinals of Champions League. And even stuff he had done for the U.S. in more minor situations had a lot more interest than the Dortmund stuff.
That's interesting.
He has driven many episodes of this podcast with things that he has done. And I wondered at times, particularly early on, did the U.S. soccer fraternity or media, which I would include all of us in, because I'm not pushing this on someone else, but did we overburden him somewhat with because it is, it may be smaller. Actually, it's massive in my view. It's enormous.
That Boy Wonder watch that we started playing that, what, 3 years ago?
I mean, yeah.
It's an interesting one because I still think the amount of coverage in U.S. soccer media overall is not nearly what we see in other sports.
Right.
Now, I used to cover basketball at Sports Illustrated for many years, and I would do soccer on the side. So I did LeBron James, all of our first stuff with him at Sports Illustrated, and we put him on the cover in 2002 at the age of 16 before he'd done anything. And I compare that to right around the same time when I was covering Freddie Adu, who was emerging as, I guess, a 14-year-old. And obviously there's a big difference in the trajectories of LeBron James and Freddie Adu. And I think what happened with Freddie Adu has influenced how we view the U.S. soccer media's treatment of young players. And yet,
in terms of what, like a fear of
you're going to ruin him. You're going to you're
hashtag
ruin
the
this,
next to do.
You're going to ruin this kid's life. And yet, I look at the coverage of LeBron James from a much bigger U.S. basketball media, and it didn't ruin him.
No, he turned out all right.
That's just,
but he didn't start any games at 14 years of age either.
Yeah, I mean,
that was when I look back at that, I think.
But
that
but the spotlight that ESPN was airing his high school games, so like he was still a teenager and was under incredible.
I think that's just part of the deal. And any kid in Argentina who's very good is going to get Diego Maradona or now Lionel Messi comparisons, and you just deal with it.
Yeah.
And some players will get through it, some won't. And you know, so far, Christian Pulisic is getting through this just fine.
Kind of looking at a broader scope of U.S. soccer right now, you know, we're talking about Pulisic. There's a young core of players that it feels like they're beginning to, I guess, establish themselves as kind of the next generation of hopefuls for this country. And what I'm trying to determine when we're talking about, you know, McKinney and Adams and Sargent, and I guess even Zach Steffen, who's at Man City now, you know, American soccer fans are starved. You know, it's like being in the desert and there's a puddle. Is that water that it's, you know, it's muck and it's whatever, but you're so starved for it that it tastes great? Or is it really like brilliant spring water?
I want you to abandon this analogy immediately. I know what you're saying. Like, are they as good? Are we seeing it through the starvation lens?
Right. I look at what we're seeing here and we're seeing guys in their teens like Josh Sargent. And guys who are, you know, around that age or a little older, Tyler Adams, McKinney, that's really exciting to see these guys playing in the Bundesliga. Mm-hmm. And I look back at any stretch in the history of U.S. men's soccer and how many players at that age were playing in one of the world's top leagues in Europe. There's not many.
The trust factor in these managers to just say, we're going to blood this kid, means they have got quality, in my view.
Or they really, they see some real promise there. And I, you know, from talking to Tyler Adams, it sounds like he's been told he'll get a shot to be part of the rotation at Leipzig. And he just flew over to Germany on January 1st.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, these are good possibilities. They're promising. I don't want to say this means the U.S. men's national team is back, right. You know, or this is a team that is going to threaten to go deep at the World Cup. But the ingredients are there for fans, I think, to have some excitement about what these guys are doing at a real club level. And interestingly to me, that's in Germany more than most places, especially England these days. You know, Pulisic's going to be one of a very few, very few Americans in the Premier League, but clearly, the Bundesliga offers more opportunities to younger players to get real experience in high level games and not have as many of the work permit requirements that you've seen over the years for England.
Josh Sargent, this is a player that gets me excited. I've said on this podcast, I don't know how many times, he's the pick of the bunch. I firmly believe that. The cameo against Peru, even, he had limited touches in that game. Peru dominated possession against a makeshift US. But those touches were fantastic and showed a soccer savviness way beyond his years.
I just interviewed him for my podcast this week.
What kind of guy is he?
You know, he's been missing America. Like, he's like, he was back home in St. Louis, and I was like, so, he's going to be back? He's like, I miss the food. But he's a guy who's also really embracing this opportunity at Werder Bremen, a guy who, you know, did turn down Bayern Munich and Dortmund to sign with Werder Bremen. And he was, I think, a little impatient, he said, to get his first team opportunity. I think he thought it was going to come a bit earlier than December, but man, he's grabbed it, you know, with both hands.
Turning down those clubs, was that based on just wanting an immediate opportunity to play? Whereas if you go there,
That was his take on it. But yeah, I don't want to be unfair to like a Jordan Morris, but like Jordan Morris had an opportunity to join Werder Bremen and didn't do it. And you only get so many opportunities in your career. And you got to take those opportunities. And obviously, there's a long way to go in Josh Sargent's story, but 3 substitution appearances, 2 goals so far in the Bundesliga, scored on his debut for club and country. I mean, the kid's really promising.
Yeah. There's that cliche, high tide raises all boats. And I sometimes wonder about that. We're talking about Pulisic before, you know, his success in Germany and now this kind of wave of American players that have gone to play in Germany. Now Pulisic going to England on this massive pay, $73 million that we talked about. You know, will his success or failure at Chelsea, you think, create or, I guess, ruin potential opportunities for some of these other young American players to make some of these high-profile moves?
You know, I would certainly hope not. I mean, you would think we're far enough along now that the future American player opportunities in Europe aren't defined by one case. Mm. That would go against everything we've learned about smart decision making. I would like to think that players in the late 80s and the 90s, you know, the first Americans over in England in any numbers would have sort of taken us through that process, but maybe that's not totally the case in some ways. And especially for coaches, I do think there's been so few coaches,
I think
American coaches over there.
The coaching is a bigger one, I think. I think player-wise, the way clubs are run now, they're international organizations anyway. It's all about what you can do. I don't think people are focusing on passports so much. The coaching is different, though, as we've
I think
seen.
Bob Bradley did run into some anti-American stuff over there. He also didn't get the results he needed. At Swansea.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see what Jesse Marsh does. Some rumblings that he might be in line for the Red Bull Salzburg job, like the head job, mm-hmm. next season. And I just thought that was an interesting move to go from being the head coach of one of the top teams in MLS to an assistant coach
yeah.
at Leipzig. And he would say, look, I want to coach in Europe at the highest levels, and I'm taking a step sort of backward to go forward here. And that to me is an intriguing move, almost as much as any of the U.S. players going over to Germany.
Yeah. Talking about managers, Greg Berhalter obviously is the big name now here in the U.S. Was it the right, you know, people were, I guess, critical of the way in which U.S. soccer went about it, but in the end, did they get the right guy, you think, for this job?
I mean, my feeling is that Greg Berhalter may well be the right guy for this job, may end up being a very good choice. I don't think there's any way you can say he was the choice mm-hmm. because I think there's a lot of possibilities that could have worked out okay.
Like who would be one of those possibilities?
Jesse Marsh, yeah. I think, would have been a really good fit and would have been ready for that job. I think there's, you know, if Bob Bradley... If you saw his resume and didn't say Bob Bradley on it, you would say that guy should be one of the top contenders for the U.S. job. Now, does that mean that he should have gotten the job? I don't know. I think he should have gotten more consideration. Uh-huh. What I wrote was the Federation did a really poor job of the search process. And there were a lot of things that happened that were unacceptable. The weight, obviously, a big part of it. But also the idea that Berhalter was the only candidate
yeah.
for them, which I think is not in Greg Berhalter's interest, because when you have a guy like Julian Lopetegui come to you and say, I'm interested in the job, and he did do this, and the response is, and they haven't named a coach yet, the response from U.S. Soccer is, we're good. We're too far along in the process to even do an interview. That's crazy. That is absolutely crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about how it just felt like they had boxed themselves in with this arbitrary set of qualifications. You know, has to speak English.
Tata Martino would have been a good candidate.
Yeah,
you know, why not interview him? I mean,
so he was not interviewed.
In the end, there were 3 people who got formal interviews. So it was Greg Berhalter, Oscar Pereja, and one still unnamed. I think Dutch is what it sounded like from what Ernie Stewart said. I'd like to actually find out who this was.
Yeah.
Who
Ronald
said,
De Boer, Frank De Boer, one of the De Boers.
could be. Actually, it's less likely, though, because what Stewart said at the press conference was that he was notified by this person that he had a job. So this was last fall before DeBoer was hired by Atlanta. So I presume that person would be Dutch. There's very much a Dutch influence in U.S. soccer right now.
Yes.
And so I'd like to find out who that person is. But it's crazy to me why you wouldn't speak, have formal interviews with other people. I think any process where you're making an important hire, it's important to find out what people's ideas would be and to learn more from people. If you're Ernie Stewart, you may not know very well. I'm mystified by
Grant,
that process.
I'm mystified by this. What exactly is Ernie Stewart's job? Because that is not very clear to me. And even when he's been pressed on it by your colleague Alexi Lalas, it was very vague middle management speak. I'm not sure. What is his role?
So I agree with you on that. I think when Alexi asked Stewart on national television, what do you do? The response wasn't good. It was very mealy-mouthed, blah, nothing stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's a worrying sign. You know, on paper, his job is as the general manager of the U.S. men's national team. He is the guy in charge of hiring the national team coach, and then he's in charge of, like, supposedly, like, organizational stuff involving the national team. What we do know specifically is he is not in charge of the U.S. youth national teams.
Okay.
It sounds like, even though before he said he was not in charge of hiring the Olympic coach, he may actually be in charge of hiring the Olympic coach now. I mean, I was joking with people that Ernie Stewart should have announced his resignation the second they hired Greg Berhalter.
Done.
Like, my work is done here.
Yeah.
Now, keep in mind that this new job, part of the requirement for the U.S. coach is that he live in Chicago and basically work out of the same office at U.S. Soccer with Ernie Stewart. And so then the question becomes, what are those daily things going to be that Ernie Stewart is working? You hear the word collaboration a lot these days. And so,
but we heard a mad thing about style of play. So Ernie would dictate the style of play and the manager would fall under those parameters. That doesn't work.
I mean, I think what it was Stewart talking to people, trying to figure out what is the style generally that we would like to play on the U.S. men's national team. And I will now hire a coach who fits that. And then the coach decides. The coach is the coach.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, but I think the way Stewart was trying to explain it publicly is that helped him to winnow out the candidates if he felt like this coach is associated with a style that we don't really have the players to play or want to play.
Was price an issue? Was cost an issue? I'm not disparaging Berhalter, but was there also a criteria or a bandwidth for how much money there would be spent?
I would certainly hope not, because this is a federation that has a surplus of like $140 million right now. So, and also where Jurgen Klinsmann set a precedent that this job could pay someone upwards of $3-4 million a year. Now, I also think one of the dominant themes from U.S. soccer in this whole process, or over the last year or two, is we're going to do the opposite of Jurgen Klinsmann. We spent 5 years with Jurgen Klinsmann, and we don't want to be involved in that type of thing anymore. And so often you see when someone is fired, we want to have someone in a sort of direct response to that. And
right.
I think they view Bruce Arena as sort of like a very stopgap measure, and they view Greg Berhalter as more of a longer-term thing. So Berhalter was going to be hired in response to Klinsmann, not to Bruce Arena.
Okay.
And so I think when you look at the word process would come up a lot. I think there was a feeling that Klinsmann basically had no process. He was very much, you know, kind of flying real quick from one thing to another like a hummingbird and never really stuck with much of anything.
That came across pretty clear, I think, during games even.
And one thing you can say about Greg Berhalter is he's a process guy. He's got a plan. He has a strategy. This team will have an identity. And sometimes that may mean players that people think should be on the national team based on their club performance may not be on the national team under Greg Berhalter, but he'll at least have a method. And I don't think he'll be somebody who just like will try a thing one day in training and then try something completely different the next.
Yeah, week. Like say, for example, on the eve of the Mexico game, we're going to three at the back.
Right.
Exactly. In terms of the personnel for the U.S. team, you know, we talk all the time on this podcast that there is no bigger lightning rod name right now than Michael Bradley. We bring his name up and Twitter goes wild. I'm sure you've seen much of the same. Is there still a place for him? I know he's part of the or he's going. It seems like he's going to be part of the team, at least in the immediate future. Is there still a place for him among U.S. soccer?
I think in a sense right now, it's almost like it doesn't matter what we think. Greg Berhalter thinks there's a place for Michael Bradley in this U.S. men's national team. That's why Bradley has been called up for the January camp. If you read the tea leaves and what Berhalter said on the day he was hired when he was doing all this press in New York, he talked about a mix of older guys and younger guys. And so he clearly thinks there's going to be some older guys in, you know, bringing some of the veteran experience. And I think there's an unanswered question yet as to what that means for Michael Bradley. Is he a guy who absolutely has to play if you have him in camp for a game?
Yeah.
Is he a guy who absolutely has to be the captain? You know, because other guys have worn the armband when Bradley hasn't been there. Even Pulisic, Tyler Adams says straight up, I want to be the captain of the national team. He's like 19 years old, which is pretty ballsy when you think about it.
Yeah.
And so what role will Michael Bradley have? Whether he's wearing the armband or not, he's going to have a big influence on what happens inside the team. And when you saw the language being used in the announcement about the January camp and being in Chula Vista, Greg Berhalter actually wants to take it to a place where he thinks he can build, quote, really work on building a team culture and get expectations across very quickly in this month of January, where I think what happens inside that camp is actually far more important than the two friendlies at the end of the month.
Is Bradley a guy that can be a leader in a new era for this team, that can put in that team culture?
I think he can. You know, I get frustrated because I think Michael Bradley, sometimes everyone's seen as either a pro-Bradley guy or an anti-Bradley guy. And I think it's possible to say that, to be critical of Bradley's performance at times, I don't think he had a very good club season at all last year.
No.
Not to say that he's capable of coming back this year and getting back to what we had seen from Toronto and him the previous couple years. But I do think it's going to be important for him to play well at club level. Clearly, you know that he and Berhalter have had some conversations about what's going to be expected of him. And I think in general terms, I think it's insane to think Michael Bradley should have been excommunicated from the national team for life.
People wanted
based on failing to qualify for the World Cup.
They wanted a scene from The Passion of the Christ. We got whenever we would say anything that we had a podcast that basically suggested what you did there. It would be lunacy just to cast him aside, and that.
Right. There will still be veterans on this. Like, people just wanted anybody who had anything to do with the Trinidad disaster gone. And that was just never, I don't know, to me it felt like that was never going to be the case. That's not a reality.
The U.S. isn't Brazil. It's not like we have the luxury of dozens and dozens and dozens of A-list national team players.
No, our experienced World Cup veterans. Yeah. No.
So why would you throw that out? I've had dinner debates with Alexi about this, where he was actually an excommunication guy. Like,
was
excommunicate
he really?
Bradley from
I would not have
from the national
him
team.
That.
I said, Alexi, I said, Alexi, like, what if that had been done after your team's failure in the 98 World Cup?
Yeah.
And so
you would have gutted.
How many players that were involved in the 2002 World Cup quarterfinal run were part of that 98 team?
Absolutely.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
You know, some guys who were like front and center, like Brian McBride, some very useful complementary players like Kobe Jones, Claudio Reyna.
Right.
You know, there were several guys. And so I think just to sort of, in some fit of anger, like say, you're done with the national team, even though you're 29 years old and a huge part and can still have some good years left.
Yeah.
The U.S. can't afford to say something like
that.
It's
just not prudent.
Decisions made in emotion are not typically the best decisions.
That's probably why it was good that Sarakin kind of slid into the fray.
Yeah, we needed a year of transition.
Yeah, Steady Hand, who was also kind of a part of the previous regime. Yeah.
That said, I still think a year, more than a year of Sarakin, it's not his fault, but I just feel like that was way too long.
But Grant, what would they have learned? This is my argument. I'm not sure that even a manager comes in and he can do all the cultural stuff that you want, and he can do even all the say he wants to play a pressing game, he wants to play out from the back, which I firmly don't believe he'll ever get to do. And you could do all that, but these are friendlies, they're just not the white heat of even a Gold Cup quarterfinal or a game away to Guatemala. It's just not the same.
What I wish would have happened is that they would have, once Carlos Cordero won the U.S. soccer presidency in February, early February, so Ernie Stewart, the GM, didn't start work until August 1st. So you're going from early February to August 1st. That was unacceptable, okay. That delay to get the GM working for U.S.
Right.
soccer.
Okay.
So they should have hired someone much earlier, and that person should have been in charge of getting a coach, even Greg Berhalter, who I think would have taken the job, ready for the friendlies that started in September.
Okay.
And not so much for the it was good competition, but they're still friendlies. I get it. But it's kind of like what I was saying about the January camp. Far more important is how many days would that coach have had with his A team to get that culture being built earlier? It would have been a lot of days over the two-game windows in September, October, November.
And fairly decent opposition.
And so now the U.S. has gone from having what would have been a head start, what should have been a head start on other countries around the world with the new regime, now the U.S. is actually behind other countries, which is crazy.
I guess, but in what way, though? Because, look, there were problems that I had with the process of how they selected the coach, but when they did it, the amount of time it took, that for me, that wasn't really one of them. So they come in January, Gold Cup is this summer, a World Cup isn't for another 3 years. How far behind are they really? You had some countries on the eve of the World Cup, not even talking about Spain. What was it, Japan? There were some countries that made changes in just a couple months beforehand.
I can respect that, but and this goes back to another chapter in my book on Roberto Martinez, who's the coach in my book. And a lot of that chapter is him talking about the differences between coaching at club level and national team level. And he's like, the biggest single challenge of a national team coach is the amount of time you have with your players. Which makes sense, but it's all that, you have this luxury as a club manager for having so many training sessions before the start of a season, but how many training sessions does a national team coach have in a year? Mm. And so he's like, you really need to have as much time as possible with your players to try and build that culture. And now I think, because of the delay, I think Greg Berhalter has a higher degree of difficulty to try and build something for the Gold Cup this summer when he's only going to have his very best team with him, theoretically, in the March FIFA window and for a friendly or two in June right before the Gold Cup starts.
Yeah, in terms of the Gold Cup, not to go too deeply into that, but I think myself, a lot of fans are wondering, what is the expectation now? We took this huge step back, transition year, young players enter the scene. Now, okay, a Gold Cup is coming up this summer, which I think is something to be excited about. Is the expectation going right back to we should win this thing? Or is that a little bit unfair to Mexico, Costa Rica? Where do the U.S. slot in right now in terms of this part of the world?
It's a great question. I think on paper, the U.S. should be talking about wanting to win the Gold Cup. You're on home soil, as you always are at the Gold Cup. You have a team with
don't do that.
You have a hungry team with talent that is capable, very capable of winning this tournament. I think Mexico right now, when you look at what they have on paper, it's probably a slightly better team than the U.S., but not by much. And even Costa Rica,
it's an aging side.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and so I view it as the U.S. should get to the final of the Gold Cup. And expectations wise, if they don't get to the final, that's a failure. Mm-hmm. And I do think there is this degree of difficulty that Berhalter is facing, in part set up by the way U.S. soccer mishandled the process of hiring him.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, this guy was far and away the only candidate basically for the job. And you're like, really? Well, you better be good then. You know, yeah. You better get results. And so I think there's going to be certainly an element of the fan base that's going to be thoroughly disappointed if the U.S. does not win the Gold Cup.
I feel like that's just in – like we had this whole – after the U.S. lost to Trinidad, we had this whole thing where we kept hearing how arrogant American fans were, American soccer is. And so we decided to implement anytime we felt like we were being arrogant, we tried to shock ourselves.
Tasered ourselves.
Right. Like, is that – we can sit here and say all we want, you know, okay, let's be humble now. But, like, is it just kind of inborn in this generation of American fan to think, look, this is a CONCACAF competition. Like, we're the U.S. We should be winning it. Like, can we just never really get rid of that feeling within us?
I don't think that's arrogance at all. I think if you're a U.S. fan, your expectation should be to win the Gold Cup. And – if I kind of have a problem if you didn't think that, right?
And considering also, and it's no disrespect to these great nations, but there are small, tiny islands that will be played in the build-up to a semi-final against Costa Rica. And it is not arrogant in the least to expect a team to blow them away and be at the business end of the Gold Cup. It just isn't.
Yeah. Well, that's not even – I'm not even really – no offense to the, oh my God, I'm really in line for one of these. But I'm really just talking about Mexico or Costa Rica.
Yeah, right. And it's also, in the last Gold Cup, they, which the US obviously won, they didn't put out their full teams either as well. And I think, well, we spoke about how that was a little bit of a, remember we beat Costa Rica and we're in the studio and we are just trying to temper things down because of
because we knew where we were.
We knew what was coming in Harrison. Yeah, right. We didn't know that, but...
that's true. We were very positive around that time. In terms of, you know, it's so funny. A year ago at this time, you know, look how much players like McKinney and Adams and Stefan. I mean, these, you know, Sargent, these guys are like mainstream now. I mean, they have arrived. American fans are viewing them as like a real hope. So fast forward to this time next year, who are some of those players that you think are, you know, kind of on the radar now that could take a similar step?
Oh, good question. You know, I mean, when you look at what guys are actually doing for their clubs, we've seen Tim Weah with the national team a fair amount now, and he's had some pretty good moments, but he's barely played at club level. Yeah. And so for him to go to, is it Celtic?
Yeah.
I don't think that's confirmed yet, though.
That's why I
– wasn't he there over – wasn't he in Scotland over the weekend? Or?
Maybe, but yeah. I have yet to see the official –
yeah, so you know, like, I think that could be a good opportunity for him. I think he's got a lot of promise. I'd like to see him emerge. I think he's certainly doing just fine in the confidence area of the game, having spoken to him. But you know, I want to see how a player like him can do. I'm trying to think if there's going to be like any MLS guys that emerge or other guys in Europe.
We've talked about Haji.
Haji Wright at Schalke. Maybe, Emerson Heinemann is actually playing pretty well in, and has played a couple of times at number 10.
How old is he now?
He's 24, I think. I don't think. Yeah.
He's younger than I would have said 25 or 26.
I think I was reading that he's now gone back to Bournemouth.
Yeah, which is, he was doing well at Hibs, and he's not going to play for Bournemouth, so I'm presuming.
Well, not necessarily. I don't think
he's
that was
not going to play for Bournemouth.
You've decided.
But he won't. Where does he fit in?
Well, we'll see.
And that's not, let's not argue about this part.
I mean, you mentioned a guy like Haji Wright, and yeah, that's an intriguing possibility. There's a third American over at Schalke, Nick Tidigui, who Schalke clearly is willing to give opportunities to their American players. Mm-hmm. And that's awesome. And, you know, we'll see if any of these younger guys playing for the under-20 national team, Tab Ramos's team, emerge from the U-20 World Cup. I mean, they had a successful tournament. Mm. They beat Mexico every time they play them, it seems like.
Before we let you go, you know, it's so easy to go on and on about the U.S. men because in times of uncertainty, it just feels like there's a ton to talk about. Meanwhile, the U.S. women have a World Cup coming up in a few months from now. Not quite as much uncertainty there. I mean, is the expectation, we're talking about the U.S. men and their Gold Cup expectations, but what about the, is the expectation for the women still, if they exit this summer without a World Cup trophy, is that a disappointment for them?
Yeah, basically anything but winning is a failure, and that's what they've earned.
Yeah.
Is that respect with what they've done over the years, and a 2018 in which they were unbeaten. And there were a lot fewer questions about Jill Ellis by the end of the year than there had been maybe at the start of the year.
Are you concerned about qualifying and what a breeze it was, that there's some kind of reckoning coming in France? Because that was, I mean, it wasn't qualifying. It was a cakewalk. There was She Believes games that were tougher than actual qualifying.
Oh, and training sessions, I assume, are tougher for the U.S. than any of the teams they played in the CONCACAF tournament. Yeah. And actually, I was talking about that with Julie Ertz just today for my podcast about me asking her, are you concerned about the defense really not being tested very much?
Or at all.
Especially in recent months. And she said, you know, not really, because every day in training, we go against each other. And we have coming up some tough friendlies. You know, they're playing away in January at France, at Spain. Those are two pretty good tests. They're going to have a pretty decent preparation schedule ahead of the World Cup. But there's going to be questions until the World Cup when they actually face some really good teams, especially about defense, about goalkeeper. You know, I kind of find Alyssa Nair fascinating, not so much in and of herself, but as not Hope Solo, basically, because we haven't seen the U.S. play in a major tournament without Hope Solo in goal. We haven't seen Alyssa Nair tested all that much, and there's a belief that has been a downgrade in that position, and that is something that could really bite the U.S. in a moment that really matters at the World Cup, say when you're playing in a quarterfinal against France and Paris.
Can I talk about the other end of the field with you? I remember going into 2015 and saying creatively, the final third, Megan Rapinoe is absolutely crucial and nothing bad may happen to her. And I think I'm saying the same thing again. Is that a concern?
Yeah, because she's had injury issues over the years. What I would say is I'm stunned that Megan Rapinoe has been able to rebound in the way that she has from the terrible knee injury that really hurt her for the 2016 Olympics. But I thought she was done with the national team at that point. In the last 2 years, she's found another gear. She is a tremendously influential player right now. And the 4-3-3 they're playing, from an attacking perspective, has to rank among the best attacks in the history of the U.S. women's national team. With Morgan had a terrific year finishing as the lone center forward. You've got Rapinoe on one wing, Tobin Heath on the other wing, Mal Pugh is somebody who can have an influence as well. Horan had a terrific year for club and country. I mean, I think it's fair to ask the question, is this the best U.S. women's national team of all time? And the only reason we can't answer that, one of the reasons we can't answer that definitively, is because of the defensive stuff we were talking about and just not having been challenged all that much.
Yeah, well, you would think Ertz was a striker at times.
Yeah, I mean, she is an absolute weapon on set pieces in the box with headers. I mean, like, it's something that teams just don't seem to have a response to.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, you've been so generous with your time. Before we let you go, we talked about your book a little bit. You're on TV. You have a podcast. You write for Sports Illustrated. What is your favorite thing to do around the sport?
I love my job, and I'm really lucky to be able to do soccer full time for the last 10 years. I love the people involved in soccer in the U.S. and in the stories. There's so much variety, whether it's the domestic game and the men's and women's side, the growth of MLS, or the international game and the growth of European soccer in the United States. And that was kind of why I switched out of basketball to soccer over a decade ago, was because I liked basketball, but I didn't think there was a huge variety of stories like there is in soccer. And I loved that ability to kind of address so many different things and storylines, and soccer is interwoven into so many cultural and, you know, all that stuff around the world, and it's global. So that's what I love. Probably the single thing I love the most are doing long interviews for my podcast with people, because to me, they're more like old school magazine style interviews that I used to do a bit more often. But now I can do these every week. They're not sound bites. You can really get at someone's story and their thoughts on something, and really get to know somebody, I think, more for these podcasts. And for me, that's fun to be able to do that one day and publish it as a podcast the next day and have people listen to it.
Who's somebody that you've had on in one of those interviews where you walked away just like blown away, just impressed beyond what you were maybe going into it expecting?
I mean, Tyler Adams recently was the first time I'd done a sit-down interview with him. And I said to him at one point, I was like, you're like the oldest 19-year-old I've ever met in my life. And I say that as a compliment, you know, like just so mature. And you come away from it thinking, this guy's not crazy at all when he says he wants to be the captain. Like he could be the captain right now of the U.S. national team, I think. And so that really stood out to me. But I think we're pretty lucky in American soccer to have the quality of interviews that we have, you know, and I think that applies to the U.S. women's team, some of these young guys on the U.S. men's team. You know, you mentioned Michael Bradley, a guy who is always going to give you an interesting interview. And his dad, Bob Bradley, he's one of my favorite guys to interview because you know he's going to challenge you at some point, and you have to be ready and bring your A game for that interview. Like I remember interviewing Bob last year, and we got to talking about why he wasn't a candidate really for the U.S. job, and he'd gotten off to a really good start with LAFC, and I was saying I think people may be, you know, reexamining your tenure before based on what's happened since and what you achieved as the U.S. coach, and his response was like, I didn't see you writing anything positive about me when I got fired. And I was like, okay, touche. But I like that. I like having people who are willing to be honest and real in interviews. And I think we have more than our share in American soccer.
I have two more questions to impose upon you. The first one, you were at Russia 2018. What's your favorite memory?
Oh, wow.
Because that tournament, I think we're still pining after it.
Yeah, for me, it's Lukaku's dummy against Japan on their winning goal on the break.
Yeah.
Just that whole play, really, and the comeback that Belgium had being down 2-0 in the second half to Japan. That was just such an exhilarating game.
Oh, it was the best game at the tournament.
I really enjoyed the whole thing, in part because this was the first time ever I watched every game of the World Cup. Because the U.S. wasn't there. I wasn't traveling around following the U.S. And so I literally watched every game on TV at the Fox compound in Red Square right near our studio. And so I was able to talk about the tournament and all the storylines with the knowledge of having seen the games. I was able to put together a best 11 and feel good about it.
And my final question is, do you still hear from DJ Rudenko?
Do
you guys hang out? What goes on?
Rudenko has not, or Leo, has not been to the U.S. yet, but we have exchanged messages. He had a new track come out not too long ago. And when he does come to New York, I would very much look forward to seeing him. I think we are going to connect.
And when you go for dinner, do you sit at a table on your own eating and he's behind you kind of just and you occasionally throw to him?
It's what's most comfortable for everyone.
I mean, think about this, by the way. Gus Hiddink is in this group that I'm on this nightly show with. Rudenko, the DJ, Kobe Jones, Fernando Fiore, Kate Abdo, and it was a good group of people. And I enjoyed that. If you had told me a few years ago that I would be like on the air with Gus Hiddink every night, I would have said, you're kidding me. And yet he in particular was a guy who I enjoyed spending time around and had much more of a sense of humor and a sense of fun about him than I would have expected.
Very cool. Hey, this was great, man. We really appreciate the time. It should be a fun year for U.S. soccer. We'll see which way it goes. But thank you for coming in and setting us up.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I enjoyed it.
Good stuff, man.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.